This is a production of South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
We will call the Senate Local Government Committee to order. Secretary will call the roll.
Senator Gillespie?
Here.
Klocek?
Here.
Miles?
Here.
Schmidt? Thiessen?
Here.
Bradford?
Here.
Gant?
Here.
Mr. Chair, there's a quorum.
Thank you. We have a quorum. Chair would entertain a motion to approve the minutes of the last meeting. It's been moved and seconded to approve the minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed nay. Motion carries. Our first bill up is Senate Bill 159, an act to permit counties to deposit funds in any state or national bank located within the state.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Bob Gray, State Senator from District 24, Hugh Stanley in Sully County. Behind me you have many bankers, and I hate to ruin their day-to-day by not letting them testify on this bill, but I signed up with the counties to help them with this bill, and our main proponent is not able to be here. We obviously note that there's some issues that we need to visit with the interested parties about before this should proceed, so I would ask for you to table the bill today or defer it to the 41st day as you wish.
Thank you, Senator. The chair would entertain a motion to table. It's been moved and seconded to table Senate Bill 159. It's a non-debatable motion. Secretary will call the roll. Those in favor say aye. Those opposed, nay.
Senator Gillespie? Senator Klocek?
Aye.
Miles?
Aye.
Schmidt? Thiessen?
Aye.
Bradford?
Aye.
Gant?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, there were 5 yeas.
Senate Bill 159 has been tabled. Thank you for coming. We'll be at ease for a moment while the room clears.
We'll give you some space.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right, we will have the committee come back to order. Sadly, for those on the internet, we had a full room, and the bankers have now all left. And we will move on to Senate Bill 154, and the chair will hand the gavel over to Vice Chair Bradford. Thank you, Senator. Members of the committee, Senate Bill 154 is an act to require new construction of certain structures and buildings to comply with the building code. There's a number of people who plan to testify on this bill, so I will make it quite short. What we are doing is for those local units of government who do not have a building code is have them follow the 2006 edition of the International Building Code as published by the International Code Council. Each local unit of government, as the bill says, may adopt an ordinance allowing local administration and enforcement of the design standard, so it still allows that of the local control to adopt their own type of ordinance. What this bill will do is for those units of government that do not have a building code, that this code would be followed. With that, members of the committee, I will let further people testify on the bill. Thank you.
Any other proponents for Senate Bill 154?
Good morning. My name is Ron Bell. I'm the chief building official in the city of Sioux Falls, but not here representing the city of Sioux Falls, representing the South Dakota Building Officials Association. South Dakota Building Officials is a chapter that is sponsored with the International Code Council, and we're also affiliate of the South Dakota Municipal League. And I'm here to just give a little background of the International Building Code. And prior to the year 2000, there were three model codes within the United States. There's a BOCA, which is primarily a Northeast code, a Standard Building Code, which is Southeast, and then the Uniform Building Code that was primarily the Western states. And in 1994, those three model codes joined together to form one national model code, which is the International Building Code. The International Building Code publishes a family of codes for municipalities or counties to adopt, and that includes an energy conservation code, an existing building code, a fire code, fuel, gas, mechanical, plumbing, property maintenance, residential, zoning, performance, and a wildlife urban interface code. We're here to talk to you only about the International Building Code. The building code is primarily a commercial code. It has nothing to do with one and two family dwellings. There's a separate code published by ICC, which is the International Residential Code, that for lack of a better term is a home builder's code and deals with one and two family dwellings. This bill intends not to regulate anything as far as one and two family dwellings or townhomes. This bill also does not intend to regulate anything, any building construction on any farms or farmsteads. We're talking about commercial buildings that are publicly occupied that are built throughout the state. The International Building Code is now used in all 50 states in the United States. If you look at ICC's website, they list Colorado and Delaware as the only two states that do not have a statewide building code. I believe that they didn't include South Dakota because they see that there is enabling legislation that is in place that says only if a county or a municipality adopts a code, it has to be the 2006 International Building Code. So any city or state that chooses to either update their code or adopt a new code, that law was intended for a uniform single code out there for a municipality to utilize. A little background in South Dakota. South Dakota Building Officials has a number of cities that are members of our group, and those cities include Aberdeen, Baltic, Belfouche, Belvedere, Beresford, Box Elder, Brandon, Bristol, Britton, Brookings, Canastota, Custer, Deadwood, Del Rapids, Fort Pierre, Groton, Hill City, Hot Springs, Huron, Lead, Madison, Milbank, Miller, Mitchell, North Sioux City, Phillip, Pickstown, Pierre, Rapid City, Sioux Falls, Spearfish, Sturgis, Vermilion, Watertown, Whitewood, Winter, and Yankton. So you can see that this is a code that's utilized predominantly in those municipalities that have adopted it. A majority of the larger cities do have active building inspection, have plan review, building inspection, and actual code conformance. And what we're proposing with this is primarily to have a statewide building code throughout, such that if there is a building built in a county or a jurisdiction that does not have a building code, at least that design professional has the ability to utilize a national consensus design standard. I've had architects, out-of-state architects and engineers call me, want to know what code is being utilized in a small town, and I've got to tell them nothing. There is nothing out there to protect the public. We're looking at this as a public protection bill that anybody that designs a building or builds a building should at least meet the minimum types of design standards that those communities in the state that actively enforce the code. We're looking at fire resistivities. exiting, fire suppression systems, structural systems. An example of a structural system is if there is no building code in a portion of a state where the public has the ability to go in a building, a contractor perhaps could put in a truss capable of 15 to 20 pounds per square foot, where the building code itself is typically most of the state is a 40 PSF ground snow load, which would require 28 pounds. There is nothing out there that protects the public or a building owner from a contractor that perhaps could put in something less than what is at the national consensus standard. Another point I want to stress here is that this will not mandate or require local governments to now become building inspectors. This is intended to be able to be utilized by a building owner for a contractor that for whatever reason, whether it's a structural collapse or an accessible entrance, for instance, that doesn't get put in. This would now allow a building owner to go back to a contractor to say, now we've got something here. Now we've got a minimum standard. This should have been built to a national consensus standard, which is predominantly done in a lot of the jurisdictions within the state of South Dakota. This change is supported by the South Dakota building officials, the AIA, American Institute of Architects of South Dakota, the Design Professionals Coalition, the Engineering Council, the South Dakota Fire Chiefs, and the Municipal League. So we're hoping for your backing on this. Any questions?
You want to take questions now, or? What does the committee want to do, or wait until we hear everybody? Let's just wait until.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Is there any other proponents for Senate Bill 154?
Good morning. I'm Tom Paisley. I'm the building official for the city of Spearfish, but I'm representing myself. The 2006 edition of the International Building Code has been an effective tool to work with while designing structures to meet a minimum standard. Design professionals, general contractors, owners that are designing buildings in South Dakota need to design a minimum standard statewide, not just in cities that have adopted a code. Exiting, emergency lighting, accessibility, wind loads, snow loads, frost depths, area and height requirements for type of construction, among other things, need to be considered in the design before a structure is built. This bill and the 2006 edition of the International Building Code would simply give architects, engineers, draftsmen, contractors, and owners a document to reference when they are designing structures intended for public or private use. Senate Bill 154 is much more than requiring accessibility standards. It is a bill that will provide a document to reference that is the most current standard available today. The state of South Dakota already has an electrical code and plumbing code for designers to reference. It only makes sense to provide a building code for them to reference also. The city of Spearfish has a rodeo arena just outside our city limits that holds about 2,000 people. That structure was built without a code. A couple years later, the city of Spearfish increased our jurisdiction to include a 3-mile area, and then they wanted to put an addition on this structure. We had to go through and have them add exit signs, emergency lighting, accessibility, an accessible route to get into the building. There were several things that weren't up to code in this particular structure. A rodeo arena is a rodeo arena, but they also held motorcycle racing. They also had carnivals like Halloween parties and whatnot, where they had a bunch of flammable materials bringing into the building. It just simply wasn't safe. So we're just asking your support in this bill. Thank you.
Is there any other proponents for Senate Bill 154?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Yvonne Taylor with the South Dakota Municipal League. The proponents of this bill have been very inclusive in their drafting of it. They contacted, I think, all of the interested parties and worked on getting it written. They did answer all of our concerns and were very responsive to our concerns for what this would mean to our small towns and our rural areas. And they have successfully answered all of those, and we are in support of the bill. Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Ward Whitbaum. I'm an architect and live in Sioux Falls. Also, I'm an executive director of the South Dakota chapter of the American Institute of Architects, which is a part-time position. I would ask the committee to look favorably on this bill, for we are one of few states that does not have an adopted code. I've had my architectural office for the past 55 years and have worked in many large communities that have adopted a code. I feel it's important for designers and builders and our smaller cities to be able to follow a standard code, not only for their protection, but the public in general. Granted, schools, nursing homes that are done by architects already have a code, no matter where they are, as spelled out by our state fire marshal and health department. Our South Dakota architects are concerned there is a possibility that as smaller communities are not serving their individuals as to easy access to facilities and safety that should be found in the structures. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other proponents?
My name is Sandy Dickinson. I have practiced architecture for 35 years, and I am from Vermilion. And I've been a past state president of the AIA. The only thing I wanted to add is I'm also co-editor of a magazine for architecture in South Dakota, and I'm giving out a reprint of an article that we put in our very first edition because we feel that this issue is so important. And so there is a graphic there. And what we're showing here is that the brown circles represent the geographical area of South Dakota that is covered by a building code. And as you can see, almost all of the map is blank. Now, true enough, the building code covers most of the population of South Dakota, but there really isn't any reason why a building being built in Selby shouldn't be covered. Or, you know, wherever it might be. I worked on a building in Gayville that they were very clear to me that there was no building code and they didn't have to do that stuff. So it really puts architects in a very difficult position. So I would ask that you support this bill.
Thank you. Any other proponents?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jerry Vogler. I'm executive director, and I'm lobbyist for the South Dakota Manufactured Housing Association, and we rise as a proponent of this bill. We have talked with the sponsor of the bill and have we have a friendly amendment to the bill. We've also talked with Mr. Ron Bell, with the building officials and others about this amendment, and have not come across any resistance to the amendment. Manufactured homes are built to a federally preemptive building code. That building code is the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. That every one of our homes go through an engineering and design process. Our homes are inspected. They're built for such standards as wind, structural, energy, egress, smoke alarms, etc. And it's not uncommon for our homes to be used for a purpose other than a single-family home. Our homes can be used as an office in certain instances, or hunting lodge, just a couple of examples. In existing law, in 1110, there is an exemption for manufactured housing, and we would ask that this same exemption be added to this language in Senate Bill 154, and with that amendment, we would be supportive. Mr. Chairman, would you like me to circulate this amendment, or how would you like me to handle that?
I'll ask the sponsor of the bill. Yeah, go ahead. I'll accept a motion and on the amendment. Been moved. Is there a second?
Second.
Is there any discussion and to the amendment?
Sure.
Senator Teason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Regarding the amendment, I'd like to prevail upon some of the expertise in the room. I'm wondering how it is to be a 35-year architect and be trumped by 20 years by the previous testimony. But I'm wondering if any of the architects in the room can provide information or have an opinion about the manufactured housing standards and the suitability of this amendment to exempt them from this standard. And any of you have information about this standard on which this construction takes place? Thank you.
There are two types of manufactured homes. One is a manufactured home that is built in accordance with the housing and urban development criteria, which local government authorities do not have the ability to do inspections or mandate code compliance within those structures. Other types of manufactured homes are actually IRC, International Residential Code, to meet the National Model Consensus Code that most communities do utilize as a code. So we would have no problem with that because we don't have any authority to look at a manufactured home that's built under the HUD criteria anyway. Hopefully that answered your question.
Ron, you're speaking for us as well. I'm delighted. Is there going to be... Following what Mr. Bell says,
I see we have no particular quarrel.
Sir,
pardon me.
Would you tell us again who...
My name is Ward Whitwam. I'm the executive secretary of the South Dakota, or director of the South Dakota Architects. Pardon me. We have no particular quarrel with this. I sense that the gentleman that spoke it made it very clear that the residential, and they do definitely have, I'm familiar with their many heavy codes that they have, construction codes, but I'm concerned about the possibility of using for commercial adaptation. I don't know how to answer, I'm not in a position to quite know how to answer that one.
Thank you. Senator Teason, you have.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, yeah, I want some assurance that we're not putting a loophole here that is somehow going to be detrimental to the public if we use a manufactured home for a commercial purpose. And knowing as little as I do about these standards, I've spoken with the lobbyist about it, and I was just trying to get some assurance that, in fact, the standard is sufficient or equal to or reasonable if those structures are used for a commercial purpose, and I'm not quite sure how to get to the end of that, to the answer to that.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
If I can ask Mr. Vogler a question. Mr. Vogler, you mentioned that this is the same language that is exception in other areas of statute. Could you elaborate on what that is and the rationale there, which I think will answer the senator's question?
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yeah.
If you refer to South Dakota Codified Law 1110-5, at the bottom of that, that is the section of law that gives local building officials the ability to adopt a building code. That is the section of law that gives both the counties and cities the ability to adopt a building code. And for the reasons that Mr. Bell described, There is a section, there is a exemption in that section, and I'll just read it. The ordinance may not apply to mobile or manufactured homes as defined in 32.7A, which are constructed in compliance with the applicable prevailing standards of the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development at the time of construction. So we're applying the same exemption that already exists in all of the communities that have adopted a building code to areas where there would be, where this building code would then become the default building code. And so all areas of the state would be essentially treated the same.
Senator Teason.
Thank you. I don't want to belabor the point. But is there a distinction in the fact that what we're talking about currently is a manufactured home that's been manufactured for a residential purpose being used for, instead for a commercial purposes? Is that not a distinction that we should consider?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
If I may.
Yeah.
Local officials in zoning instances can choose or not choose, to designate whether a manufactured home can be used for an office. In many areas, they choose not to. It is not uncommon for someone to use a manufactured home as an office. I'm aware of some places in South Dakota, some hunting lodges, for example, that will use a manufactured home as a hunting lodge. And I noted I noted that we talked about egress from houses. One of the things that's in the manufactured housing building code is that the doors on a manufactured home must be placed such that if an occupant is inside that house, they are within a certain distance to an egress. Our homes have had hardwired smoke alarms for I think longer than residential than other homes have, and so I think it's important to, our homes are placed in areas, in rural areas, often areas that do not have a contract, that do not have contractors. And it would be important to continue to allow people in those rural areas to have a choice and options to have that hunting lodge or have the office. So,
thank you, Senator Teason. You have the okay. Now, are there any more proponents? If not, we'll take.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Ryan Green. I'm a staff person with the North Central Chapter, Paralyzed Veterans of America. To do honor to our veterans, I don't typically misrepresent them, so I always like to make it clear that I am not a veteran. I am staff for Paralyzed Veterans. I try to speak on their behalf. Our membership is in support of this. A lot of our members in our rural areas and people with disabilities sometimes have the misfortune after a traumatic incident where they're paralyzed or diagnosed with diseases of the spinal cord, they have to move to the larger communities where buildings are more accessible and for other obvious reasons such as health care. The most important parts of this legislation have already been discussed, so I don't feel the need to elaborate on that. I just want to give you a couple more examples of some of the errors we see in rural communities in the state. Paralyzed Veterans of America, we do fundraising, and we try to keep our members and people with disabilities active in outdoor recreation. We do a lot of pheasant hunts. We do deer hunts, things to keep our members active and feeling independent. For the past 15 years, we've been doing a hunt in South Central South Dakota. I won't name the town, but we became very good friends with an individual who is a hotel owner, and we frequent this town year after year. We always come back, and he said, you know what, I've seen you guys struggle in my hotel enough. I've got the money now. I want to put a new addition on this hotel. He invested in the local contractor who didn't go by a code. We can't get into the bathrooms in the hotel, this new addition. So there's a, it's a small population. 1 in 5 South Dakotans are people with disabilities, but I think if one of your constituents called and asked you to support this bill for safety reasons, I think you'd be able to easily justify why you voted the way you did. Thank you.
Thank you. There are no more proponents.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Shelley Pfaff, and I'm the Executive Director of the South Dakota Coalition of Citizens with Disabilities. We represent people with all types of disabilities, all ages, and throughout the state, and we would urge your support of this bill. Most of the points have been spoken to. I guess the one that I would add to what has been said by Ryan and others is that at a time when organizations such as ourselves are working hard for all people with disabilities of all ages to participate in all types of activities, including recreational, which in South Dakota oftentimes is hunting and fishing and those types of activities, it's critical that we have a uniform code that would be followed so that we can indeed ensure that accessibility is going to be built in. But beyond that, it truly is a life safety issue, and we equally have concerns that buildings are being built that are not fire safety or exit or snow loads and winds and et cetera. So we would urge your support of this bill.
Thank you. Any more proponents?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Robert Keene. I work with South Dakota Advocacy Services. Very quickly, I'd just like to say me too. I think that we've heard public protection. We've heard of fire safety. We heard of egress and things like that. But I think the additional benefit of accessibility, what that means to so many people in this state, to be able to get into buildings, be able to get out of buildings, to do it in a commercial way, do it in a private way, do it as we all share the communities, I think it's very important to point this out, point out also it's not mandatory, and what it'll do also is just heighten public awareness. We certainly need public awareness for all the above reasons. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You know, I might have made a mistake. I think that we probably should have acted on the amendment. Are we all right? Okay, we're all right. Okay. Thank you. And another proponent.
Yes, another proponent. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen of the committee. Representative Eldon Niger, District 17, and I'm testifying not only as a co-sponsor of the bill, but also to just share with you a quick personal experience. We built the winery in Vermilion, South Dakota, and we used ADA requirements. And because of that, I have an older brother who's now deceased, but his last 3 years were in a wheelchair. And because we complied, for the last 3 years of his life, he was able to come home and share that investment in our community, and that part of it's a resort or B&B. And because of complying with ADA requirements, I can tell you that the salience of that investment really strikes home when it's one of your own family members. So my brother, Dr. Lowell James Nygaard, was able to visit us, share that, stay overnight, go to the bathroom, access the building in and out on his own, whereas he had stopped coming home because the farm places and the homes, that the old homes out there on the farms, you couldn't get through the bathroom doors, you couldn't turn around. They were not friendly to people with physical challenges, and I just want to speak in behalf of this bill. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there any other proponents?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Larry Zuckman, the president and CEO for the ATC Building Chapter, South Dakota, and registered lobbyist for ADC. We do not have any problems with the bill. We will support the bill, and so that's all I have to say. But we don't have any problems with it. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other proponents? If not, Are there any opponents? Are there any opponents? Well, not. We'll go back to the amendment. And, yeah, well, we should do something about the amendment, shouldn't we? Before we ask questions.
Is that possible?
Yeah.
I don't know what the form is here. Again, my name is Sandy Dickinson, and I'm an architect. This bill exempts homes, all homes, whether they're, you know, stick-built, manufactured, mobile homes, all homes. But if you were to take a home and make it into something that is not a home, then it needs to be covered by a building code. And so I'm a little concerned about this amendment, just from that standpoint. Because if you take a mobile home and put it out and make it a bar, it's going to have a different needs for, you know, floor loading and exiting and fire codes and all those kinds of things. So, you know, we just have to be really careful about that. As a home, it's exempted anyway.
Thank you.
I have a comment on the...
Okay. I'll open it up for committee questions.
And, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to support this, but I'm having some trouble, and perhaps this, Senator Gant, maybe this question should be directed to you. Or anyone else who is comfortable answering it. I guess I'm looking back to the current statute under 1110.5, and what that says, if you have an ordinance that requires standards for the new construction, then the ordinance must comply with the IBC, but you can amend and change whatever you want. And then what this says, what this bill proposes is that if there's no ordinance, then it still has to be based on IBC, but it's got this exception here on line 10 that says, but the local entity may pass an ordinance allowing local administration and enforcement of the design standard. So what are we trying to do with that exception, Senator? And are we trying to give the option to pick and choose what of the IBC, similar to the existing law in 1110.5? That's where I'm struggling. And I'm sorry to make my question so compounded, Mr. Chairman, but that's where I'm struggling, Senator.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Gant.
Thank you. The intent there is to make it that one lady brought the map of the state on where the building codes are and where they aren't, that if, I think she used Selby as an example, if Selby decided to adopt their own code, this legislation would allow them to do that, where it wouldn't mandate that they have to use this if they so choose to implement one of their own. That is what we're trying to allow here, so that they could implement theirs and not have to follow this. But for those areas who have not implemented, they would follow this.
I'm having a hard time, Senator, not calling you Mr. Chairman, so you have to forgive me. But if I could have a follow-up,
yes.
Mr. Chairman. Senator, then I guess... But it's mandatory in this those first four lines that it has to be based on the IBC, and again I support the bill, but I just need to understand because it seems to me that based on what your response, Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that it still is mandatory that they use the IBC. Is that right?
I'll defer.
Thank you, Committee. Ron Bell with South Dakota Building Officials. That language was put in there to allow a municipality that otherwise never did have a building code, but now the building code is out there. Now, if that municipality chooses to actually adopt the building code, we certainly did not want to take away the ability for that municipality or county to be able to make local modifications or local changes, just like every other community that has the ability to adopt that code anyway. So we wanted to make sure that the ability for a local community that actually chooses to adopt it then has the ability to make modifications to that code.
Thank you. Are there any other questions? Senator Teason? We can go to the amendment if you're no more questions.
Mr. Chair, I have a question regarding the amendment that I would like to address to a member of the audience.
Okay.
Appropriate. My question continues to be, I guess, the suitability of the manufactured housing who meet a presumably good residential building code, whether that is standard, is suitable when it's used in a non-residential commercial purpose. I'd like to ask the gentleman in the front row, I'm sorry, I got confused on names. I know you had a comment on that. I'd like to hear that, and perhaps the representative of the lobbyist for that organization as well.
My name is Jerry Lindberg. I'm an architect here with the AIA today. I guess my question was a little bit, or a comment was a little bit a question. I was looking to Ron Bell for some info on this, but it's my understanding if a building undergoes a change of occupancy, a change of use, then the code would have some effect, would it not?
That's a very good question.
Right. But if it was changed from one use, a home, to a business, that building would then have to meet at least the area and occupancy requirements. So, you know, there's some built-in protection just in the UBC, IBC itself. So I would think
Senator Keegan.
But in fact, the amendment seeks to exempt these structures from IBC.
It exempts it when they're being constructed, but if it was to become another occupancy, there would be some requirements. It would have to meet the requirements of that occupancy. That's my understanding. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you want to answer that?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, if I may.
Yes, you may.
The key to this is that the Federal Manufactured Housing Act is federally preemptive. And as Mr. Bell previously described, local governments do not have the authority to enforce building codes regarding manufactured homes, and that is the reason for the exemption. The federal law does not give local governments the authority to regulate manufactured homes that are built to the Department of Housing and Urban Development standards, That is the key, and it doesn't, that code doesn't restrict whether you're using that home as a residence or something else. I guess that would be the answer to my question. Or to your question, I'm sorry.
One last question, then I'm done. So you're saying that your manufactured housing could be used for any other purpose besides residential and would be exempt from the code, that it's preemptive. So you can build a house to a home standard and then use it as an office building or whatever, and you're exempt.
Mr. Chairman, if I may.
Yes.
The federal act is preemptive. Now, if a local government adopts zoning ordinances, and there are other options available to local governments, but regarding the building code itself, which is what Senate Bill 154 addresses, is the building code. The federal act is preemptive, and homes that are built to the federal act, local governments are without authority to regulate those how those homes are constructed. And that's what Senate Bill 154 addresses, is the building code.
Just a minute. I have one. Is this, as an example, I think one of our schools had to have a new, and they brought in a pre-manufactured and just set that up and started using it as a classroom. In that case, I mean, that would be similar to what could be allowed.
Mr. Chairman, if I may?
Yeah.
Yes. We've had instances where schools have used a manufactured home as a classroom. And keep in mind that our homes are delivered into rural areas, often where there are not other opportunities, contractors available. And we serve an important need and niche. And that was the thought process behind that. So, Mr. Chairman, if I may, the answer to your question is yes, that is an example, and it's an example where schools will come in, and often on a temporary basis, but they'll do that.
Okay, thank you. Is there any more questions? Many? If not, we'll go to action on the amendment. The amendment's been is now open for discussion. Is there any discussion on the amendment? I would like to say that I don't know if I think the amendment should be on it. In my cases, I see the I see those communities. He read off those communities, and I'm sorry to say, but I didn't see a single one in Shannon County, of course, and I didn't see a single one in Bennett County. So I would say that those communities may need this amendment, so they in the cases of not having availability of some contractors. So with that, I will ask for a vote on the amendment. And it's a voice vote. Those in favor of the amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
No.
Amendment passes. Now I'll open it to motions. Or Senator Miles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to pass as amended.
Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Senator Gant. Is there any discussion on the motion? Senator Miles.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I think based on the map and the discussion we heard today that there is a gap in some of the areas of our state. From a safety and a consumer protection aspect, I think this is a really good move. I appreciate all the support and the collaboration all of you guys have had to bring this forward. Just for the like I said, a public safety for the people of all the people of South Dakota, not just certain areas of the state. I think it's a good first step, so I really commend you for doing that. So we'll support that. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there any other discussion? Senator Teason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I concur with Senator Miles. I think this is an important step. I think it is helpful and necessary for consumers. My objection, of course, my questions / objections remain with the amendment, but I think that the rest of it provides a good solid basis for good building practices in the state. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Gant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to reassure Senator Teason that over the next few days, Mr. Vogler is going to make you become an expert in manufactured housing issues, and you will be jumping for joy on the Senate floor to vote yes.
With that, I will close the discussion and call for a roll call vote on the Senate Bill 154 as amended. Will you call the roll?
Senator Gillespie? Senator Klocek?
Aye.
Senator Miles?
Aye.
Senator Schmidt?
Aye.
Senator Thiessen?
No.
Senator Bradford?
Aye.
Senator Gant?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, there were five yeas, one nay.
So, Senate Bill 154 is amended to go to the floor with a due pass motion, and I'm sure Senator Gant will handle that. We'll now move to Senate Bill 110. And I'm sorry, Senator Gant. I don't have 110 either. I think Senator Gant.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 110 is an act to repeal a certain portion of our campaign finance law. As all of us experienced since we won our election in November, we had to fill out our campaign finance disclosure, and we all should have filled out two of these. So if you haven't filed your second one, the Secretary of State is behind me here, and he will collect your $50 per day plus interest, I'm sure. But back in, must have been the middle of October, middle end of October, we had to fill out a pre-general campaign finance report, which is the same report we had to fill out for the year end. The one distinction is if your campaign or your campaign committee were to have raised or spent less than $10,000, you didn't have to go through the process of filling in all of the contributors who contributed over $100 to you. You wouldn't have had to list anything, any PACs that had given you money, any parties, in-kind contributions, other income, your expenditures, how much you spent on billboards or mailings or phone calls or yard signs or whatever you may have had. All you had to do was check this box at the beginning that says, I raised and spent less than $10,000, and then on your last page of the finance report, indicate what those amounts were. What this bill does is it removes that exception for those campaigns or candidates who raise and spend less than $10,000, so that all campaigns and all candidates are on the same page. If I raise more than $10,000 and I receive a $1,000 check from someone, I'm going to have to write that on my campaign finance report. In the future, I think that if your campaign raises and spends less than $10,000 and you get a $1,000 check from somebody, you should also have to report who that individual is. When we changed and created this law a couple years ago, I think there was some belief that the reason we needed this was, I just run a small campaign, I don't raise very much money, I don't spend very much money, why are you going to make me fill out this big report? Well, I contend that anyone who raises more than $10,000 has a much greater job to go through and get all of their contributors there, all of their expenditures there, and then balance the report at the end. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I would encourage the committee's strong support of Senate Bill 110. I think by passing this, we will make our campaign finance laws even more open and accessible to the public.
Thank you. Are there any other proponents?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Chris Nelson, Secretary of State, rising as a proponent for this bill. When we brought the major campaign finance revision to the legislature in 2007, this section was not in our proposal. This section was added through the legislative process, and it was certainly not my preference to add this exception. But it was nonetheless added, and as we went through the first election cycle in 2008 with this exception in place,
our observation is that this has caused a great deal of confusion in two areas. First of all, prior to either the primary or general, when legislative candidates are trying to figure out, do we file the short form or do we file the long form? And we had some that would fill out the complete form but put the X that they wanted to file the short form. And just a lot of confusion about which way they should file that that form. Now, some folks are looking nervous here. They're thinking I'm going to name names, and I'm not going to. And the further confusion then came at the time of the year-end report, which Senator Gant made reference to. Folks thinking, well, I filed the short form, and so any money that I collected or spent prior to my election, I don't need to report that at all, and I only need to report what I did after the election, and so a lot of confusion about exactly what do I report. And that confusion literally would go away with the removal of this particular section, and it would be very straightforward. On your pre-primary or pre-general report, you report everything up until the 15th day prior to that election, and then the report after that picks up from that point, and you report everything after that. And so I think for a whole lot of reasons, this is a very, very good bill, and appreciate Senator Gant for bringing it forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other proponents for Senate Bill 110? Any other proponents? If not, are there any opponents? Any of you nervous people, opponents? well, with that, I'll close the testimony and open it to questions and or action. Sure. Senator Teed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I'll move due past and then I have comments.
Okay. Is there a second? To the Dupet. Okay. Comments, Senator Tease.
Thank you. Well, first of all, I could only wish that I would arrive at a time where I could have checked the little box, but I don't know if that time will ever come, and if we get rid of the little box, then it's not going to be an option for me anyway. So I think I live in a district and in a city where it doesn't seem to be much of an option usually. But and secondly, this is the... this is the 2009 version of the legislature. This is the open-minded, open governments version of the legislature. And I think this is a good step that we can take to prove it. So I'll be supporting this.
Thank you, Senator. Any other comments? I have one. Secretary Nelson might testify. I think I checked every box and wrote down everything because I happened to be one of the guys last year who got a one-day penalty because I brought it here and I was 15 minutes late. So I got a $50 penalty, and I'm very conscious of that. So I make sure I check every box and write everything down. But I too think this is a good idea. Then you know where you're at right from the beginning. And I too want to thank Senator Gant for that. So with that, we'll have a yes, Senator Cloture.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I just, of course, Senator Napoli led the charge to put this little box in, and you know, I'm sure he'll find out about it after dinner, and then we will be hearing about this for the rest of the week. But we will try to, you know, see to the wishes of the Secretary of State on this issue. But there was some concerns for streamlining, make it easier for those that had less campaigns. And of course, we bend in this legislature. We never break, but we bend to try to help our constituents and our good Secretary of States.
Thank you. There are no other comments. We will go to action and call the vote.
Senator Gillespie? Senator Klocek?
Aye.
Miles?
Aye.
Schmidt?
Aye.
Thiessen?
Aye.
Bradford?
Aye.
Gant?
Aye.
Mr. Chair, there were 6 yeas.
Go to the floor. Motion do pass. And I'm sure Senator Gant will take that. I don't know if we can have a a motion to maybe we perhaps we shouldn't since it's a to put it on consent. No. Okay. With that, I'm going to turn the gavel back over to the chairman.
Thank you, Senator Bradford. With that, we've concluded our business for the day, and the chair would entertain a motion to adjourn. Moved and seconded that we adjourn. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. We are adjourned.